As if his indomitable spirit had set its potency in motion, the glass blazed suddenly like a white torch in his hand. It flamed like a star that, leaping from the firmament, sears the dark air with intolerable light. No such terror out of heaven had ever burned in Shelob's face before. The beams of it entered into her wounded head and scored it with unbearable pain, and the dreadful infection of light spread from eye to eye. She fell back, beating the air with her forelegs, her sight blasted by inner lightnings, her mind in agony. Then, turning her maimed head away, she rolled aside and began to crawl, claw by claw, towards the opening in the dark cliff behind. Two towers. Welcome to episode 8 of the Grey Company podcast, and the first of our series discussing the four different spheres of the Lord of the Rings LCG. Since its inception, the card game has been about spheres. Even with the inclusion of traits, nothing influences deck-building decisions in quite the same way that spheres do. On this episode, we will have a close look at the Spirit Sphere, discussing its characteristics, its strengths, its weaknesses, and decide just how important it is to your deck.
It's episode 8 of the Grey Company podcast. My name is Derek. As Matthew said at the top, this episode of the program inaugurates our discussion on the four spheres of influence. Specifically, we're interested in the usefulness of the Spirit Sphere, known far and wide as the Blue Sphere. We'll get into many facets of the sphere, what it was designed to do, and how to use it effectively, but the real question we'll be focusing on is how important is the inclusion of spirit cards in your decks? Spirit is the only sphere that can cancel when revealed effects, so it is helpful in just about any play session. This week on the show, we'll help you to figure out when and if it just has to make an appearance. But let's start by checking in with the crew. Ian, how have you been doing?
Doing good. Continuing to play Voice of Isengard and trying out different decks against those quests, and also finishing up playing the last couple Nightmare quests that I never got a chance to play. Nightmare Return to Mirkwood specifically.
Cool. Matthew, how have you been?
Oh, pretty good. Haven't gotten any Lord of the Rings play in, sadly. School is picking up, work's picking up. It's sort of that time of year, but otherwise, I'm fine.
Great. How about you, Dan? What's going on?
Not much. Actually had a chance yesterday to play some Lord of the Rings at the local game store, which
nice.
Is cool. And hadn't done that in a while. Played Black Riders and were able to beat that. Nice. And then next week, I'm going to do the Season 3 Nightmare with some real-life human beings, so that'll be good.
That's cool.
I was, for a while there, I thought that Austin was dead when it came to any kind of local scene, but it looks like there's a few people still playing it, so that's
nice.
Exciting.
Did you get a four-player game together?
Just two-player last night, but next week should be four-player, so four-player Nightmare is interesting.
Mm, well, yeah. That's when you just put your hand down and you say, guys, it's okay, I do a podcast about this game. And everybody breathes a sigh of relief.
And everyone uses Glorfindel.
Nice.
Well, since this is the first episode with a strict focus on spheres, let's kick things off with a little bit about the sphere system en masse. So, Dan, could you talk a little bit about, or at least get us started talking about, the reasoning behind the spheres and kind of what they do in the game?
Yeah, so I think a good way to look at it, for anyone who's played other card games at all, it's a theme you'll see really in every card game, is that you have to split, you know, essentially split the game up into some kind of groupings, just to give some variety. So like Magic has the different colors. It's the same kind of analog in this game. You know, the spheres are a way of kind of thematically, from a high level, breaking up the cards so that you're not just, you know, you don't have access to every card in the game in every single deck. And the nice thing about this game is, you know, true to form with everything else, it's very thematic in how the spheres are divided up. So for the most part, you can kind of understand why a certain hero, you know, the Corset Aragorn is leadership.
Right.
It's obvious. That's like, that represents the king, you know, the king of men returned. And, you know, so it's cool that not only is it a mechanical way to kind of break the game up, but it also really fits thematically.
And I think it was, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, at the beginning of the last cycle, the Against the Shadow cycle last year, where lead designer Caleb said something about how this game is about spheres. And I think with Outlands and Gondor, and especially the dwarves, since they had gotten so much attention in the Dwaradelph cycle and then again in the Hobbit expansions, maybe there was some thinking that this game was going to kind of focus more on racial or national traits that we've seen. And there is that. But I think he wanted to emphasize that this game is really about spheres. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it was in an interview that some of the guys over at Team Covenant did with him at Gen Con.
Oh, that's what it was, yeah.
And I always thought it was interesting that they chose to base it around spheres, because it almost seems like the logical thing would be to have this game based around the traits. So you would have like a dwarf trait, a Gondor trait, and those would be basically the replacement for the spheres. But they didn't choose to go that route. And, you know, I'm kind of glad they didn't, because it gives you two things to kind of consider and makes deck building more interesting than if it would have just been get your dwarf deck together, get your elf deck together.
Right.
Yeah, I think, and I agree with you, Ian, that would have been my initial take on where the game should have gone. And in retrospect, I agree they made the right decision. The more that I think about it, when you look at, like, the Fellowship, for example, it's this almost random mix of people from all over Middle Earth. So it kind of fits that, you know, you have that ability to, staying within a few spheres, you can play lots of different traits if you want. And, you know, you can get good combos there. Obviously, some of the best combos in the game are going to be trait specific, but it's cool to be able to mix and match, you know, depending on what it is you're trying to do.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of lumps things more by character traits than by strictly national or racial traits. Like, and it's very clear in the writing that not all dwarves are the same way. Not all men, not all hobbits are the same way. So it is kind of cool that they almost take that character aspect into play when they're assigning characters and events and things to spheres. So let's go ahead and start talking and go in a little bit more depth into the spirit sphere, which is our focus for this episode. The core set rulebook says that the sphere of spirit emphasizes the strength of a hero's will. Determination, resilience, courage, loyalty, and heart are all aspects of the sphere. So that's, you know, what the core set said. Was it coming up on 3 years ago? Is this still what the spirit sphere is really about, you know, thematically and kind of abstractly in the way it plays out in game mechanics?
I think so. Reading this quote made me think of Captain Planet and the little dude who has the heart ring. You know, and he was always like
resilience.
Yeah, he was always like didn't do much. Certainly not like blowing fireballs at people or whatever. But I will say that I think spirit sort of is the heart ring from Captain Planet. And I think that the sphere does, you know, willpower is what this sphere excels at. And so I think while willpower is sort of an abstract concept, unlike attacking or resource generation, or maybe even card draw, I think you could think of willpower as determination or resilience to get through some of the less friendly places of Middle Earth successfully to reach your end goal, which would be questing.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there's kind of a balance between like creating this game mechanic and what it actually means. And that description itself is really broad. It can include a lot of things. I mean, you think about someone like Grima, who has 2 willpower. He has no courage, no loyalty, really. But you could say he has his own kind of determination and resilience, right? Yeah. To carry on that kind of the task of Saruman for so long. So, I mean, you have someone like him who has the same willpower as Aragorn, for example. And you kind of take a look at that and be like, what? But at the end of the day, they do have these kind of game considerations to take into account, that they can't give someone like Aragorn like 5 willpower as well as 3 attack and that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, the one, and obviously it's kind of ambiguous what resilience really means, but the one thing that where I feel like spirit maybe doesn't quite hit on what they say it is in the core rulebook is just, it's interesting to me that there's very few spirit heroes that are, or characters of any, you know, allies for that matter, that are good defenders. And it's kind of surprising given the theme of the sphere. Mm-hmm. I would expect that. I mean, I think it's good that they released Blood of Numenor in, I think that was in the Heirs of Numenor set, where you can actually, like, if you've got extra resources, you can boost the defense on a hero. Yeah. Like, that seemed a long time in coming to me, because that's one thing that I think the Sphere should be really good at, is defending, and it's interesting that you have a lot of low defense heroes and low defense characters in the Sphere.
Yeah, and one way they kind of tried to compensate that was the actual Against the Shadow card, where the characters would then defend with their willpower, so it kind of flips it around and tries to, and again, abstractly because it's a game, but make it seem like they're resisting the enemy by their strength of will rather than their strength of arms. But that's a lot of abstracts. Let's kind of talk more in terms of game mechanics. What is this? What does the Spirit Sphere actually do? What is it good at? Like questing, anyone listening to this podcast doesn't know.
And more questing.
Yeah, questing.
Attacking.
Curveball.
Yeah, I mean, Eowyn being in the core set, it's pretty clear, and she's to this day the hero with the highest starting willpower.
And, yeah.
And most overrated.
Pretty clear. Huh?
And most overrated.
Yeah. Very funny.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of the big questing power, way more so than any other sphere. I'd say probably leadership is next in just raw willpower, but. Mm-hmm. Kind of going back to the abstract thing, I think one of the reasons why it is feels abstract is because questing in the game is abstract. Depending on what quest you're doing, it could represent anything from like trying to run after Faramir to like swimming down a river. So it can be really abstract what it means. But yeah, it's definitely the questing sphere first and foremost more than anything.
And after that, you get into the, you know, and you can kind of go back to the core set again and see what one of the other themes is, with Eleanor being, you know, the one of only two ways to cancel when revealed. Mm-hmm. The cancellation is another really big theme in the sphere. It's interesting, though, that really those are the two cards, Test of Will and Eleanor, that can cancel when revealed, and we haven't seen anything else that touches that since then. So it's kind of established the... you know, the theme, but then they haven't really riffed off that much at all when it comes to treacheries.
Yeah, to me, the interesting thing, and I think it is interesting to go back to the core set and compare the heroes, because these are sort of our first impressions of the spheres, leadership's pretty consistent. All three of them sort of do something with resources, whether it's spend them to ready or gain them in a certain way. The tactics ones are mostly, you know, revolving around killing things, or, you know, they're attacking, doing something, or adding damage. The spirit ones are sort of all over the map. So Eowyn, of course, is still probably the premier quester in the game. Eleanor cancels when revealed effects, which those are the two things I think we all think of when it comes to spirit. But then we have Dune here, sort of the odd man out, who isn't very good at questing. He has nothing to do with encounter deck cancellation. And he gets an attack boost for attacking alone. I'm not so sure how that represents spirit, per se. But it's interesting. I feel like the other spheres, as far as their hero complement goes in the core set, are a little more consistent with how we think of the spheres today. Whereas in spirit, I don't know if that's so true.
Yeah, I think kind of going off on that, the thing with spirit is it got these abilities which are so crucial, and they cover so many different parts of the game. So you're thinking about canceling treachery, so totally nullifying like one of the key encounter card types. Questing, which is basically how you win the game. You think about the ability to provide redding through unexpected courage or reducing threat. Those are all huge parts of the game, and spirit gets it all to itself, while something like tactics, it can fight, it can attack and defend, which, yes, is a big part of the game, but in some ways, I feel like Spirit almost got a broader share of abilities than the other spheres did.
For a long time, right up until Heirs of Numenor, most people said that Spirit was, you know, far and away the most powerful sphere. And I think a big reason for that is what Ian just said, is that it gets things like Galadrim's Greeting, A Test of Will, you know, Eowyn, and it makes it much more of kind of a I can do everything on my own sort of sphere, especially once they got Spirit Glorfindel. It solved the one problem that Spirit had, which was combat.
Yeah, so there you have a hero who's really good at questing and really good at combat.
Yeah. And the thing is, all those cards you mentioned, Dan, were in the core set, which is like Spirit didn't even have to wait. A lot of the cards that Spirit got are still kind of staple cards. You just throw them into your Spirit decks now.
Absolutely. And there's also a little bit of location control in there as well, which further complements the questing aspect of Spirit. Cards like Rittermark's Finest, Thrower's Key, of course, the Northern Tracker, who's still classic. So yeah, they do kind of have a well-rounded package, which is interesting because leadership kind of seems to me to be the natural choice for the catch-all sphere, because it's got pretty good questing, it's got the resource management, it's got decent attacking and defending. But you're right, I think with kind of the odd smattering of heroes and then the emphasis on basically encounter deck control, it definitely is one of the more powerful, you know, monospheres, so to speak. So if that's what Spirit does, or is meant to do, I guess the next question to ask is, when do we have to use Spirit, or when is Spirit maybe the best option? Or is it even, you know, the real big question is it necessary to use Spirit to be successful if it is this kind of well-rounded, powerful sphere?
I've gone on record in many places and have said, you know, again, I'm pretty much exclusively a multiplayer. I don't play solo. So in two-player games or even three or four, I think at least one person, perhaps in a four-player game, two people need to be running Spirit, because there are so many treacheries that will come up again and again in a multiplayer game because you're cycling through the deck that I'm going to want to cancel. Now, with that said, I don't know if I'm in the minority opinion on that, but there certainly is a dissenting opinion to my position. Just the other day on the forum, someone was talking about how you don't need Spirit anymore, how you can build a mono leadership dwarf deck, for example, and handle just about anything the encounter deck's going to throw at you, or what have you. So, to some degree, I think I can empathize with that position. In other words, Spirit for many players has perhaps become a crutch that we don't need anymore. We're sort of conditioned from our early core set days 3 years ago to think, oh my god, I've got to cancel these nasty treacheries, because if I don't, it wipes out my entire board state. And maybe I've never really graduated from that position. I still have that little, my little infancy, oh my god, I need this. So every game I play, someone has it. But it's not even so much needing it just for the cancellation, though. I love it for that, and I'll often splash Spirit in my deck for that. But you almost need Spirit just because, as you said, Derek, the goal of this game, as much fun as combat is, and how that's my favorite part of the game, it's ultimately questing, and questing successfully. And the sphere that can do that the cheapest, the most quickly, right, the best, is Spirit. And so it's not that the other ones can't do it, certainly in a mono situation where you're only flipping over one card, but if you're flipping over four cards, you really need at least one player to have questing down solidly. And in that sense, does that make Spirit necessary, a requirement to win? I don't know if I would go that far, but it certainly makes your task a hell of a lot easier.
Well, the leadership dwarf deck is an interesting proposition, because it doesn't do the job with any kind of finesse the way cancellation would. A leadership dwarf deck is just going to be
brute beefed up.
Exactly. It's right. Just going to have enough bearded gentlemen there to take it on the chin.
Right.
And other spheres have that ability as well, where they, if you play your decks to their strengths, they're going to be able to, you know, not cancel the effect, but they're going to be able to have the means to deal with it, even if it hurts.
Right.
Yeah, Gondor leadership is the same thing, by the way, and it's now actually doable thanks to Visionary leadership, where you can get, you know, Boromir, stick Steward of Gondor on him, and get, you know, Visionary leadership, and just throw an army of little, you know, weenie Gondor dudes on the board, and you can definitely win quests with just a bunch of, you know, random guys. So it's, yeah, you're absolutely right about it being not the elegant approach, but it can work in the place of Spirit. But what you're really doing is you're saying, instead of having a few heroes that are doing most of the questing, you're kind of, you know, winning through numerical superiority in that sense. I wanted to touch on one thing as far as the treachery cancellation, though, because I think this is an important thing to bear in mind. And it's easy to talk about deck building in generalities and say, well, do you need cancellation or not? And this is going to sound kind of like a cop-out, but I think to be fair, it depends on the quest. Because if you take, for example, one of these mono leadership decks, you know, Gondor or Dwarves, against some of the early scenarios where the worst treachery you're going to see is something like the Necromancer's Reach. So it's like, well, if I've got hardy leadership, so all my Dwarves have got at least two hit points, I can quest with everyone, not really care if I run into one of these guys and everybody takes a damage, they're all still going to be alive, I'm going to be able to get through the quest. You know, and again, kind of brute force approach. if that's the worst treachery you're facing, yeah, you can have a mono leadership deck and not have any cancellation and pass it just fine. On the other hand, yeah. if you go into like Heirs of Numenor and you're seeing, you know, Watcher in the Woods where, you know, that treachery can raise your threat by 20, especially if you've got a deck with a ton of guys, like, that's one of those must cancel kind of treacheries. And if you're going into that quest with a mono leadership deck, you're basically saying that one out of three games, I'm probably going to lose to a treachery that's going to completely hose me and I can't do anything about.
Yeah, I think I think in general, I kind of have the same opinion that it depends on the quest. For a long time, I was playing with a mono leadership and a mono lore deck two-handed. So completely Xing out all spirit, and I was able to beat some of the tougher quests in the game, almost most of the quests in the game with those two decks. But so I think it's not necessarily that spirit is always essential, at least for the majority of quests. But what it does mean is that because like a Test the Will, for example, just completely cancels that out. You don't have to worry about whatever effect that is. If you don't include that, then you have to include like three or four other abilities to compensate. Because yeah. if you think about what treacheries do, I mean, there's only a limited set of things that treacheries do. They deal damage, they fetch enemies, they raise your threat, maybe they'll exhaust the character. So if that's the case, you're going to have to include other abilities that basically cover all of those possibilities depending on the quest. So the nice thing about spirit is with that Attest the Will, that just covers it right there rather than you having to kind of include all these different backups. And the funny thing is spirit includes those effects that will help you deal with treacheries even when you can't cancel them, like redding in case your character gets exhausted, like threat reduction in case it raises your threat. So kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, it almost feels like spirit kind of got the sweet deal.
Yeah, and I like, there's an article you did in, like, you know, kind of towards the early stages of your blog where you compared the different spheres and styles of deck to kind of characters in RPGs. Mm-hmm. And I used to play the Lord of the Rings Online RPG a lot, and you'd get these enemies and they would start to cast a spell or, you know, ready their ability, and it was like you either hit the deck and took it on the chin, or if you happen to have the right class of character there who could just cancel it. And so it's kind of the same deal here where, you know, leadership has lots of allies and resource smoothing, which can be used to handle the encounter deck. You know, lore's got card draw and other encounter deck manipulation, and tactics is just kind of raw power. You can use those things to counteract nasty treacheries and things like that. But it's so much nicer if you can just kill it before it even hits the table.
Right. And kind of like going back to what Matthew was saying, it becomes even more important to do that in three or four player games because a lot of the treacheries in this game don't scale very well when you add more players, like especially the fetching enemies or like revealing encounter. Like when you reveal one extra encounter card or two, it's like, okay, when in a four player game, you have to reveal four extra encounter cards on top of the regular staging. That's when you just quit. That's when you just flip the table at that point.
Yeah, we played four-handed fight at the Fords of the Game Shop this week, and Down from the Hills came out, and there was like one time counter left, and it just ruined the game for us.
Yeah, the number of players is important, because I was gonna mention that in the case of solo, a good way to get around not having spirit is definitely lore. That's one of the in Bjorn's Path, the deck that I had built for that. The first deck that I built was Leadership Lore. And that was one of the ways that I dealt with stuff like Hills of Imminent Mule that has, you know, stuff like Rock Slide that'll just completely wreck your whole board state. And basically I just always made sure Denethor at the end of every round was looking at the top card and saying, okay, if it's Rock Slide or something that's gonna totally hose me, you know, put it on the bottom of the deck. And that's, you know, it's not perfect, but in a solo game that can work as a way of, you know, offsetting not having any true cancellation. But as you guys mentioned, once you get to multiple players, that just stops working. You know, when you're revealing four plus, usually five or six because of Surge and other things, cards per round, you have to, like Matthew said, you pretty much just have to have cancellation there. You're going to be in for a rough time. One other thing I'll say in terms of, we've been talking about it in terms of questing, but now that there are battle and siege quests, and there are also some kind of non-traditional quests where they won't have any progress tokens that you put on the quest stage, and it's more about fulfilling some condition within the game state. it is nice that that opens it up to other decks, so you can actually, you know, maybe play a mono tactics deck and some of the Heirs of Numenor stuff, because, most of the stages you're going to be using attack to quest, so like, you know, it gives you a little flexibility there, but in almost every case, those scenarios will have at least one stage that's traditional willpower, and that's where you're right back to, you know, Eowyn and Spirit Glorfindel are kind of the go-to cards for dealing with that.
I have never really played games without spirit, I don't think. And Ian, you mentioned that you've done leadership and lore, and Dan, you've done the same thing. Do you find, on some of the most difficult quests in the game, so do you guys find that the games are more fun if you don't use spirit, because spirit is or could be viewed as a crutch? Do you find them more tense because, oh my god, I can't cancel, and so here we go? Or what is it like to play without spirit?
Well, it was very scary at first, like the first time you're going off swimming on your own without, like, someone holding you, I suppose. It's definitely more tense. I don't know if I would say it's more fun. I have had the experience where you just kind of load up this mono spirit deck and you include, like, Dwarven Tomb and Map of Erenil and just recycle Test of Wills forever. And I think when you get to that point, it does... I don't know. Sometimes it does kind of take the fun out of it. But if you're playing against, like, the hardest nightmare quest, sometimes you don't really care. You just want to beat the thing. But in general, I don't know if I would say it's more fun. It just felt... it was just nice to kind of move away from those spirit characters, and it just felt fresh. It felt different, but I don't know if it would necessarily be, like... a big improvement, like, I will never play Spirit again because of that.
You wouldn't necessarily recommend it.
Well, people should try it out, but it's not like, yeah.
I think a way to respond, for me to respond to that, is when I first started playing this game, I just wanted to win, and I would get so annoyed with the game when I would spend all this time to build this beautiful deck, and then something would happen, and I would just lose, and I would just be like, and I'd fudge the rules just to make it so I could win. So, when you're in that position where it's your perspective on the game is, I just want to win, then there's no reason not to include treachery cancellation, because it smooths the game so much more. But when losing is fun, or when you really want to see the full wrath of the encounter deck, or when you're really just kind of getting into those, like you said, those tense situations where, like, you know, the horsemen are closing in, there is kind of a thrill to that when you see really just how bad the encounter deck can get. So it depends on your approach to the game. If you just kind of want to see what can happen, and if you really want to try different kinds of decks and enjoy it from that perspective, then it's great. But if you just really want to have a more comfortable game and get through it and show that you can win, then yeah, you need it, because I was begging for a Test of Will when that Down from the Hills hit the table this week, and we all just kind of wound up laughing about it, because now we had like 10 Dunlendings in the staging area, and, you know, allies are getting killed left and right, and the timer is going down, and so in the end it just got kind of so ridiculous that it was funny, but at the same time it's also nice to win.
Yeah, I actually would say that I enjoy playing without spirit. Not that I have anything against it. I just think I enjoy variety playing the same. I mean, it's one of the reasons why deck building's an aspect of the game that I particularly look forward to doing, rather than dread. And, you know, I'm sure everyone that gets to where they've got most or all of the card pool, you know, you look at Spirit Glorfindel and Light of Valinor and Asphaloth and Warden of Healing, and there's just kind of this, like, control spirit lore deck that almost builds itself, and you can even throw Elrond in there, and Vilya, and you can just have this insanely dominant deck that, and I remember when I first got that deck built, and be able to go through pretty much any scenario in the game, and just lock it down. And even when you've got Dwarven Tomb, and you're bringing back a Test of Will, or you're bringing back Galadrim's Greeting, and you can just completely control the staging area, you know, Ranger Spikes, and, you know, you name it. As the card pool grows, like, that control deck archetype just gets better and better and better. And it's fun, and especially, like, in Nightmare, I still really enjoy that archetype, because even that archetype can get crushed in Nightmare. Yeah. But in normal scenarios, honestly, I do like branching out and going without spirit sometimes, just because being able to lock down the game and completely control the staging area and completely nullify whatever the encounter deck's trying to do, at a certain point, to me, it just gets boring.
Yeah.
Like, I want to have the risk that I'm going to lose, or if I make a mistake, I could lose the game. That makes it more interesting to me. Yeah. So
perhaps we should challenge ourselves as a group to play a four-player game with no spirit,
oh,
and I vote Passage Through Mirkwood.
That's a good vote.
Nightmare Passage?
Just regular Passage.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I would bet, though, if we built four specific decks and really thought about it, that you could build, you know, and maybe not some of the other Nightmares, but I bet you could build four decks with no spirit in them that could beat Nightmare Passage through Mirkwood.
Maybe for that, oh, maybe definitely. For that one, yeah, it's possible. Yeah, I would say that generally I tend to throw my strong decks at a quest, beat it, and then I feel free once that kind of monkey is off my back to play with all kinds of decks. And that's kind of how the mono leadership thing was. I had beaten all those quests before, so I guess it did make it more fun. Like, I actually encountered these treacheries that I'd always just cancel. And had to figure out how to work around them because they were actually affecting me this time. But I think it is telling that when it came time to play the Nightmare Quests, I discarded those decks and went with Mono Spirit, Mono Tactics.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where, you know, it is definitely a matter of degree, because it's one thing saying, oh, I'm going to work around this treachery that does one damage to all my exhausted characters, and it's another with some of the treacheries in Nightmare where it's basically cancel this or lose the game.
Yeah. And sometimes an octagon, that's not so bad because it's just a click away, but sometimes you just don't want to go to all the trouble of shuffling those cards back up.
Right.
Well, we've kind of weighed in here on the necessity of spirit and what we like about it and its role within the game. We've talked a little bit about how in a multiplayer game, it's nice to have your mono spirit deck for questing and cancellation. We've, of course, brought up the almighty Glorfindel, and he's kind of a key to the Mono Spirit deck. Let's talk a little bit now about some other options when you're playing Spirit. Let's just kind of open up the table here, maybe to hero choices or ways to splash Spirit, like you mentioned that, Matthew, splashing it in your tactics deck, or maybe even some auto-include Spirit cards.
In some senses, I think, I don't know if I want to say it's more important than treachery or shadow card cancellation. We haven't talked much about Hasty Stroke as a side note, which yeah. I think is the little brother to treacheries. Treacheries tend to be worse than shadows, but some shadows are horrible, right? If it kills the defending thing's an ally, you discard it, and then it's a dead hero, right? That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
In some cases, worse than whatever a treachery could ever do. But with that said, Unexpected Courage still to me reigns supreme. Yes, there are other methods of readying heroes, but none are as cost effective or as versatile as Unexpected Courage. And so, you know, I care more about drawing Unexpected Courage perhaps than Test of Will or Hasty Stroke.
Yeah, action advantage stays huge. But with Hasty Stroke, it's kind of the inverse to Unexpected Courage, because there are lots of other ways that are maybe more effective ways of dealing with shadow cards, like Burning Brand comes to mind. But still kind of having that Hasty Stroke loaded in the chamber is really effective as well.
Yeah, it means you can be more risky, right? You can do an undefended attack and not worrying about it kill your hero or those sorts of things, yeah.
Yeah.
If there's one criticism I have of Spirit, really, it's I feel... kind of thinking about these cards like Hasty Stroke and Unexpected Courage and A Test of Wills, I feel really limited when I build both Mono Spirit decks and, like, if I'm just splashing in one Spirit hero. As far as I feel like I have to include these cards if I want to win and maximize, you know, the power of this deck. And so I'll include, you know, these key events, these key Spirit attachments, and then there's not a lot of space to include these other Spirit cards that are kind of cool, kind of interesting, but that's not going to help me win, so I'm just going to leave them out and they're going to keep collecting dust. And, you know, I feel that way with the Heroes of Spirit too. I feel more so than with any other Spirit, the hero choices are kind of limited. Like, if you're not playing dwarves, because there's like two or three spirit dwarves, I think, it's really limited. And my mono spirit is pretty much always Frodo, Eowyn, and Glorfindel, and I would like to move beyond that. You know, I can include Kaldara or someone else, but it's just, in some ways, I feel like the spirit decks almost build themselves more so than any other sphere.
Yeah, because the heroes you just named are so good at what they do. Yeah. Really, that those are the obvious choices. I mean, Frodo is the best defender out of spirit. Eowyn's the best quester, and Glorfindel for five threat is just kind of ridiculous. The one other thing I wanted to throw out there, and I'll just touch on it briefly because I know you, the rest of you guys don't necessarily play secrecy much, but it does bear mentioning about this sphere that because the low threat cost of the heroes, it does allow you to do, secrecy much more easily. Particularly Glorfindel was really the card that opened up secrecy with more than two heroes as a viable archetype. So, and with secrecy looking to come into the Ringmaker cycle, we'll be probably talking about that again at some point.
Well, let's spend some time talking about those heroes since they've come up. Thinking about it in terms of theme and also mechanics, which characters really fit the theme? I mean, is Eowyn maybe the undisputed queen of the spirit sphere, or are there other characters out there that can kind of contest her role as both the thematic choice and the mechanical choice?
I don't know if she's top dog in spirit or queen Eowyn, but she's good in so many ways. One, she just has the 4 willpower, and that can't be beat. Two, you can boost her willpower. But I find, as we played in our Voice of Isengard quest, just being able to discard cards is worthwhile, whether it's a dead card in your hand because you had multiple copies of uniques, or you want to have a small hand size. There aren't that many ways in the game to get rid of cards that you don't necessarily want, and on top of it, get a benefit out of it. And so I just think in so many ways, she can be super useful, and that I'm not so sure that any other hero matches that. And I was going to make one point about Glorfindel before we sort of transitioned to this topic, which is I find that Glorfindel gets less useful the more players you add. In other words, in a solo game, I think he shines. His threat is really low. His stats are really good. But in our 4-player games, when we're only using one version of him, he doesn't do much. I mean, yeah, he quests for 3. That's nice. He might attack for 3 if that player pulls something down. But the tactics person has the attack down. We don't really need Glorfindel's 3. Or the spirit player, which was probably Glorfindel, but, you know, that person's got willpower, and whether we had Glorfindel's extra 3 or not is probably inconsequential. So, I don't know. I mean, he is arguably one of the more powerful heroes in the game, but I'm not so sure that he's a necessary hero once you add 3 or 4 players, because there's enough heroes on the board that are doing varied things with all sorts of fun and cool abilities that I'm not so sure just the 3-3-1-5, his stat allotment, is really doing all that much in a 3 or 4 player game.
Yeah, and it is worth pointing out that the one downside to Spirit Glorfindel is he doesn't have an ability. I mean, sure, yeah, you can put Light of Valinor on him, but as a hero, his only ability is a -1. So, and in a multiplayer game, that does start to become really relevant is having, you know, essentially 12 heroes out there with all these different abilities, and you can start to work them together. I mean, we noticed that in The Voice of Isengard when we had Brand and Éomer working together. Like, you can get some really good combos going there by actually using the hero's abilities rather than just looking at it as, you know, this guy's just a body that I'm going to send questing and maybe do some combat, but he has no actual ability.
Right. Glorfindel's boring in many ways because all you really do with quests with him, hopefully not raising your threat, and then if you happen to get an enemy, he can swing for 3. But beyond that, you're right. I mean, I think to me, it's not even arguable that Brand, at least in our game, was a more fun hero, even if he isn't a auto-include in a lot of sorts, you know, in many decks.
Yeah, Glorfindel is definitely, like, the power option, not so much the fun option. I think one thing he does bring is that Noldor trait, so you can, you know, rely on the Elrond's Council and even get a Rivendell blade on him, so making that spirit deck even better in combat. So, but yeah, he's definitely not the most exciting hero. I think maybe when he first came out he was, because it was this big power option that we finally got, but over time, definitely not as exciting as some of the others. I think one of the spirit heroes that is a cool thematic and gameplay option is Frodo. I always thought it was cool that his ability reflects, like, he's putting on the ring, which of course is raising your threat to dodge this attack. And he's just been super useful against, you know, I can think of Battle of Lake Town specifically, to take these huge attacks and let you survive, which not many other heroes can do.
Yeah,
Frodo is a total thematic win and just an all-around solid hero. His trait is becoming more and more useful as well these
right,
days.
As the enemies get bigger and beefier, I think he's still... I mean, again, he's our first AP. Or no, was that Bilbo? But he was our second AP in the Shadow of Mirkwood cycle. And yet, I still think he remains relevant, more so in some cases, than Spirit Glorfindel, who, again, I think becomes less relevant. What do we have? 50-some heroes now? And so I think you can make decent, powerful decks and not have to include Glorfindel, a spirit version of Glorfindel every time.
Absolutely. And there are definitely some oddballs in the spirit mix. I'm just kind of like looking over the list here, and there's there's definitely a little bit of a rogues gallery with the spirit sphere. There's like made up people like Eleanor and Kaldara, and then you have Fatty and Spirit Pippin, which I think all, you know, if you are creating a character, then you can choose which sphere they go in. But I don't know. I think Dunhir might be one of the biggest oddballs for me because he's a warrior. We don't know that much about him from the books, except that he's kind of a lord out there in the Westfold, and he fought and died at the Battle of Pelennor. He seems like one of those guys where he maybe could have been a tactics hero, but to kind of round out the spirit selection in the core set and set up the spirit Rohan connection that was coming in the Shadows of Mirkwood cycle, they just kind of slapped a spirit icon on him. So he's probably my vote for biggest oddball as far as spirit heroes go.
Yeah, I think I agree. Though, of course, he's attacking into the staging area. He has to do it alone, which at that point in the game, he was the only one who could do it. And so the only sphere that would be likely to have enemies left in the staging area was probably spirit, because they were the sphere to reduce threat. And so, I mean, I get mechanically why he's spirit from a certain point of view, but I also agree that it is sort of oddball. He does only have 3 attack. It was very, very difficult for most of the life of this game to boost his attack to anything worthwhile. Now it's a lot easier, and he's seeing renewed play. But yeah, he is sort of an oddball, I think.
Yeah, it's less of an oddball, but it's one of the under-the-radar heroes that I actually really like out of Spirit is Nori. It works, kind of going back to the Frodo thing, where some of the heroes work so well thematically, and Nori, you know, the idea that when you're going to go dwarves, you pretty much go all in on dwarves, and especially with stuff like Legacy of Durin and stuff like that, just getting a ton of dwarves out. And even post-Errata, even though now you only lower your threat when you actually play them from your hand, not by doing other shenanigans, it still is a lot of fun to play kind of a dwarf Nori deck where you're just playing a ton of dwarves and lowering your threat as you go. And he's an interesting kind of, you know, left field choice out of Spirit, but at the same time he fits in with the sphere and he's a lot of fun to play, I think.
Is he better than Dwalin?
More consistent. I don't know if he's better. I mean, Dwalin lowers your threat more in a potential in one go of it. But I like Dwalin, right? You give him some weapons. If you know you're playing an orc heavy quest, now certainly in the Isengard, the first quest where it's all Dunlendings, then Dwalin is no good, right? Nori would be a superior option. But if the quest is all puny little goblins like the stuff from Khazad Dûm and stuff, I've had lots of fun with Dwalin, and I don't know if I usually get between 4 and 8 points of threat reduction from him in any given game. If I structure the deck well enough and against the right quest. And to me, that's worth it.
Yeah, Dwalin, to me, is really underrated, and it has to do with his stats, because I mentioned it earlier, like, good defense out of Spirit is actually really rare. So him having, you know, the 2 defense, and I want to say he has 4 hit points, and you can, you know, if you're using tactics, you can pretty easily give him things to boost up his defense and hit points from there. But... or if you want to go the attacking angle, you can give him Dwarvelf Axe or Dwarven Axe or whatever. So he's actually, I think, a good hero. And particularly, as Matthew said, in some of the earlier quests that were almost all orcs, he's really underrated.
The ones that kind of throw me for thematic loops are the 2 made-up ones, Eleanor and Kaldara. Like, I don't know what Kaldara is doing to... kill herself to bring these other allies into play. Like, I'm not sure what that's supposed to represent. I'm not spurt.
She's some sort of martyr.
Yeah, like, she goes on a suicide mission to recruit people. She's everyone's favorite, so they get pissed off when she dies. Like, I really don't get it. And Eleanor, like, does she just really have good eyesight so she sees things coming? Like, is that why she's standing on the mountain? I don't know. I mean, I guess they're made up, so it's just free reign to put whatever gameplay mechanic you want on there.
Right. I'm not a slave to theme, all right? And so in some senses, you just need a hero that fits a certain game mechanic niche. I think Brand might be a decent example of, I'm not so sure that we know much about him from the books, no. Right? And I'm not so sure that his ability, I mean, you could argue, well, he's the grandson of the dude who killed Smaug, and maybe that inspires people, and they ready again. And I mean, you could make a case for it, I suppose. But, you know, sometimes you just need a certain mechanic on a hero, and there you go. Right. And I'm okay with that. It is a game at the end of the day, and I want the game to be good and the game to be fun, and I want to have different options, and I don't want to be a slave to theme. So to sort of circle back to our original comment, I like that Caleb and the current designers, and maybe even all of the designers, have focused more on the spheres trying to be somewhat distinct, not having too much bleeding between them. Because then, you know, if you just want to make a spirit deck, I can put together all sorts of interesting characters that are coming together for the good of Middle-earth. Whether they all share a racial trait or not is irrelevant to me.
Yeah.
As long as I have a fun time playing with them, their abilities work together, and I beat the quest.
Yeah, and Caldera is a great example of what you're talking about, because I really feel like it's clear in some of the new cards, like Emery and even the neutral card Hidden Cash, that the designers are pushing a new archetype, and that is kind of, I think, Ian, you had a phrase for it in one of our last episodes about, like, kind of playing out of your discard
pile.
Yeah,
like the discard draw deck.
Discard draw, thank you. Like, that's totally an archetype that you can see them pushing, because cards like Emery are really designed around mono spirit, and obviously same thing with Caldera. Like, they want us to make a mono spirit deck with Caldera, with Emery, with some new, you know, maybe some neutral cards, maybe Zigil Miner, and do the whole Zigil Miner Imladr Stargazer thing again. And obviously he's been errated, but I mean, it starts to, like, when you do enough tinkering with your discard pile and bringing these allies out, you know, as Matthew said, it doesn't really matter if it fits thematically. It becomes mechanically viable as a new and different way to play the game.
Right, that's a good point.
And that can be a lot of fun.
Yeah, because I was very skeptical of Caldera. I remember when we were at Gen Con and we first saw that card together, and we were like, what the hell is this? Like, this is the worst hero ever. But I tried the Mono Spirit Caldera, and it was fun, and it's not as powerful as my usual Mono Spirit deck, but it's different. And especially with Spirit, it's nice to have that breath of fresh air.
And sometimes I think the nice thing about heroes or allies or just cards in general that aren't restricted by theme is those are perhaps in some senses the cards that can get better as the card pool grows, because they're not limited to just exactly how they were in the book. So what I specifically mean here is Caldera. She's not tied to anything whatsoever. Her design is purely mechanic driven, and so the more and more spirit allies we get, no matter what trait they are, no matter what race they are, if they're a great spirit ally, she's going to get better, because that's the way to bring them back for free. Whereas something that's more dependent on a certain trait interaction or whatever, it might get better as the card pool grows. It certainly could if that trait gets more love. But I think cards like her and some of the others that are more mechanic-driven, again, just get better and better and better as we have more and more options.
That's a good point.
Well, now that we've kind of made the case for spirit and provided some options for deck building, what if you were just needing to splash some spirit in for a particular quest, like if you're doing Into Aethelion, you just really need to get rid of that attacking wargs or something like that? What are some of your guys' go-to options when you just want to include spirit in your deck, maybe if you're not putting in a dedicated spirit hero?
So a couple of the premier heroes in the game have excellent options for splashing, and that's Elrond with Vilya, and then Corset Aragorn, or I guess you could even do the Loragorn or Strider, but him with Celebrian or Celebrian Stone. I always mispronounce that stupid word.
Stupid Kelly Elvish. Bryan.
That was his mom's name. Yeah.
I mean, certainly there was a post on BGG, I think, the other day, Board Game Geek, about songs. Are they still worth it? And it's funny because that topic will pop up every once in a while. And man, were songs a staple back in the day, I think, of almost everyone's deck. I can certainly think back to our progression series videos with Mitch, to where we had songs all the time. And I think it's been probably 2 years since I've had a song in my deck. I just don't need them anymore. There's perhaps more fun or more effective ways to splash cards. Or it's just, as we have sort of been talking, it's maybe less important for decks to have splashing in certain spheres. You can make a monosphere deck that can, you know, take it on the chin, as we've been saying, and you don't necessarily need to put in these sorts of things. But certainly Song of Travel is an easy, cheap way to add spirit to your deck if you don't want to have a spirit hero.
I think my favorite is going to be Oin, who is a spirit hero, but it's kind of an inverted splashing in that he can be your spirit guy, but then after you get five dwarves in play, he can kind of become your tactics guys too. And he's the only hero, I have to assume there's going to be more in the future who have this feature. But I just love that he's the only one so far who can gain a sphere at a certain point. So he's always an interesting choice.
Yeah, I was going to mention him when we were talking about Dwalin and Nori earlier. I really like him, and I think he's great. And I do hope we get more multi-sphere heroes. I don't think we should have a ton. I think that could maybe create, I don't know, it could push the game in maybe directions that become too powerful and broken perhaps. But he does it in such a way that there is a big restriction. And I don't know if having five dwarves is that restrictive. But, you know, I do think it's cool. I totally agree with you. And I hope we get more heroes like that in the future. I totally agree.
Yeah, the last option for splash is out of leadership. Narvi's Belt, if you're running dwarves, is a nice way to get to spirit. And you can kind of stay thematic that way.
True. Well, there's a lot that, you know, we've hit every single base. If there were bases in this game, which I wish there were, we would have hit every single one of them as far as spirits go. But are there any closing thoughts or comments? Anything we didn't hit, that hidden base out there in the Vales of Anduin that we forgot to uncover?
I just wanted to add, as far as allies, we touched on kind of Northern Tracker. So there's some allies out of spirit that are really, really, I would say, more so auto includes in my own spirit decks than even the heroes necessarily. I'm talking specifically about Arwen Undomiel, Northern Tracker, in a lot of my decks lately, Sylvan Refugee, especially if you can control whether or not things are leaving play. You know, less useful in multiplayer, but for solo, you know, those cards are just pretty much going to be in every spirit deck.
Well, speaking of spirit allies, for our little conclusion here, we want to pose a question, as we've been doing in the previous episodes. Which character do you guys think, you know, we went through pretty much all the heroes, or a lot of them anyway, and Dan just did a good job of talking about the allies. Which character from the books or from the imaginings of Fantasy Flight's design team will be the next great spirit hero or ally? Ian, you're first.
For me, it's got to be Sam Gamgee. In my head, he's always been a spirit hero or ally, whatever they want to recast him as later. But ever since the core set came out, he just represents, you know, reading that description from the rule book, resilience, courage, loyalty, like, that's basically describing Sam. So I can understand why they had to make him leadership for the Black Riders, because you kind of have to have a hero from each sphere when you're doing four heroes, but I hope to see him in a spirit form eventually.
Yeah, that'll be cool.
And that was my guess when it looked like we were going to get more hobbits with the Black Riders. I really thought Sam was going to be spirit, but I guess they're saving him for maybe later on in the series when he comes into his own as the big hero. Dan, what about you?
I'm going to go with Aragorn, actually. One of the things that I like that they're doing in this game is multiple versions of really key characters. And I know there's some people that don't like that as much, but I mean, the existing versions of Aragorn, I really like both of them. They're very distinct, and they both have their own niche mechanically, but they also both thematically make a lot of sense. And I could totally see a spirit version of Aragorn with a, you know, very different ability, something probably around threat. And I just think that would be a really cool hero.
Yeah. I'm going to take the easy way out and go with one who's already been spoiled. With Bilbo, we have the spirit Bilbo ally who's already been spoiled with The Road Darkens, which is the next saga expansion that's coming up in the fall. And as I've made abundantly clear on this podcast, I'm a big fan of Bilbo Baggins. He is the greatest little hobbit of them all, after all. But anyway, I'm excited to see him because, one, I like Bilbo, and two, it'll be cool to see if we see some improvements to the pipe trait. I like the pipes. I'm a little bit of a pipe defender. And so it'll be cool to see if, with Bilbo's ability, which lets you fetch pipes, we might see a little bit of, I don't know, maybe we can say clarification on the whole pipe situation. All right, we saved the best for last. What do you think, Matthew?
well, I'm not so sure that my pick is all that exciting, but given the current cycle that we're in, right, we're going to see some Noldor and Sylvan love, I would assume if we're thinking of the next great spirit hero, I can't imagine it would be anyone other than Galadriel.
Mm-hmm.
Might not get her in this cycle. She might be saved for perhaps a deluxe or a saga expansion, maybe, but I would certainly think that, she would be one, a hero at some point if we got Elrond. And if she is a hero, it seems to me that spirit will be the sphere she fits the most. I can't say that I'm looking forward to her from a personal affection. it's not a character that I really care about at all. But I can't imagine we won't get a hero version, or at least an ally version of her, and I'm pretty sure she'd be spirit.
Yeah, solid choice. It's funny, I was cycling through all the characters in the book in my head about who was going to be like maybe the next spirit character, and somehow she never popped in there. But yeah, I definitely think she would be a nice fit for spirit.
Yeah, she's actually reached out into your mind and made you not think of her.
Save it for Matthew.
That tricky mirror.
Tricky mirror. Very cool. Well, thank you all for listening. This has been episode 8 of the Grey Company podcast. Ian, will you tell the people where they can find us online and about a couple other things that are going on?
Sure. So you can find us online at greycompanypodcast.wordpress.com. That's where you'll find all our episodes. You can also find us on iTunes. If you want to send us a message, you can email us at Gmail, which is thegreycompanypodcast@gmail.com. Our next episode is going to be talking about keeping the game fresh, ways to make sure that this game doesn't get stale. We're going to talk about whether we think there's a danger of it getting stale in the future. So the four of us, which is very exciting, are planning to have a big get together among ourselves. The Grey Company crew is uniting at Gen Con, which is coming up in August. And we're in the process of thinking, brainstorming about what we want to have for listeners out there. So stay tuned to The Grey Company, and we'll have further details as our elves and orcs and Uruk-hai get that brewing.
Awesome. Well, good night, everybody.
Good night.